Welcome to Talking History. My name is Lisa Cannenberg. I'm a professor of history at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. And today we'll be talking to Professor Daniel Horowitz, who is the director of the American Studies Program at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Professor Horowitz is the author of Vance Packard and American Social Criticism. But most recently, he's published the book that we'll be discussing today, which is entitled Betty Friedan and the Making of the Feminine Mystique, The American Left, the Cold War, and Modern Feminism. Welcome, Dr. Horowitz.
Glad to be here.
I'd like you to start out by just talking a little bit about who Betty Friedan is, what the feminine mystique is. I'm sure that a lot of our audience is not familiar, especially younger people, with Betty Friedan and her role in the American history, and especially in the emergent feminist movement of the 60s. So if you just start by telling us a little bit about Friedan and the feminine mystique, we'll take it up from there.
Well, the phrase, the feminine mystique, is the title of a book Betty Friedan wrote that was published in 1963, but the title refers to a phenomenon she identified in that book, which was the way in which American women, especially suburban middle-class women, in the 50s and early 60s, had been sold a bill of goods. The feminine mystique referred to the process by which women were convinced that they could achieve satisfaction by being housewives, raising their children, cleaning the kitchen floor. And that she identified, that is the feminine mystique, as something that educators, that magazine writers, and that psychologists and others had foisted upon American suburban women in the 50s. The book appeared in 1963, in February, and was, over the long term, an enormous success. It sold perhaps 5 or 6 million copies, but of equal importance has been its impact both on hundreds of thousands of American women and on the organized activity of American women. The book is one that, as hundreds and hundreds of thousands of women read, it came like a thunderbolt to them. All of a sudden, they've reported again and again in letters to Betty Friedan and in interviews that the book suddenly opened their eyes, that they realized, as Friedan called it, the problem that has no name, the dissatisfaction they felt with their role as housewives. Suddenly, on reading the book, they realized all of this and over time were able to change their lives, to use the title of Friedan's second book, It Changed My Life. Millions of women have said that this is a book that changed their lives. And secondly, and Friedan herself and the book, The Feminine Mystique, played a critical role in launching the modern women's movement. In 1963, there was no successful organized national effort around women's issues such as sex discrimination in the job market, in higher education, in the professions, in the House and the Senate and the presidency. And Friedan's book was one of several factors that led to the creation of the modern women's movement, specifically through her leadership and that of others, the creation of the National Organization for Women in 1966, for which she served as the president. So Friedan has said, with some justification, that she is the mother of the modern women's movement, and both her organizing activities and her book played an important role in that.
You have talked about Betty Friedan's narrative of her enlightenment, how she herself first had this epiphany in her suburban home, and you've challenged that. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, what, in her terms, what that enlightenment consisted of?
And right. Friedan has said that in 1957, when she first started working on the feminine mystique, she had no idea, no commitment, no interest in women's issues. And that as she was poring over the questionnaires that her Smith College classmates had filled out on occasion of their 15th reunion, this is in 1957, as she was poring over those questionnaires, she suddenly realized how unhappy middle-class suburban women were, and realized at the same time how unhappy she was as a suburban housewife. And so, as you said, it came to her, she said, as an epiphany. And she wrote the book in order, in many ways, to give other women that experience of suddenly realizing that they, too, had been trapped by the feminine mystique. But the importance of the narrative, of her story of her own life, is this story that she had no prior interest, prior to 1957, in women's issues, and that the feminine mystique and her interest in women's issues and her leadership of a feminist movement was shaped in her mind and in her story primarily, overwhelmingly, by her own suburban experience in New York in the 1950s, and by the by studying that experience of other women.
Now, you challenge that narrative considerably in your book. In fact, that's the core of your book. How did you come to write this book, this intellectual biography of Betty Friedan, and how did you come to challenge her, discover that that this narrative was questionable?
Well, the origins of the book go way back into the late 1980s, when my wife, Professor Helen Lefkowitz-Horowitz, was directing the gender studies program at University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And in that program at that time, Betty Friedan was teaching courses. And so my wife and, by extension, I got to know Betty Friedan socially. At that time, I was writing what I thought would be, and what someday will be, the sequel to my first book, which was The Morality of Spending. And I wanted to write a book on how American writers in the post-war period wrestled with issues of affluence and consumer culture. And I saw myself writing a book that had a chapter in it, no more, on Betty Friedan. And I interviewed her in 1987, in Southern California to talk to her about her life in order to begin to get myself ready to write that book in which she would appear as a chapter. At the same time, my wife, who's a women's historian, was carrying on conversations with Betty Friedan about her being the authorized biographer of Betty Friedan. And Helen Horowitz decided in the end not to do that for a variety of reasons, but principally because she was then writing the biography of a famous woman educator, M. Carey Thomas, who had written or left behind 250,000 letters. And as you know, Lisa, as a historian, when you're in the middle of a project like that, you don't see yourself taking on another authorized biography that imposes on you certain requirements that you go through what are really hundreds of boxes of material. So my wife, Helen Horowitz, understood then that as she watched Betty Friedan holding what she called think tanks in L.A., kind of discussion groups among professional women, understood that Betty Friedan's style as a person and as an organizer was probably shaped much before her suburban captivity in radical organizations in the 1940s, specifically, my wife assumed, in the campaign for the presidency by Henry Wallace in 1948. And Helen would come home at the end, as I say, of a busy day and decompress in the kitchen and talk to me about how she knew there was a more interesting story here, a more interesting and important story. And that kind of percolated in my mind. And then in 1995, in March, if my memory is correct, I went to the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe College and looked at Ferdinand's papers. And it didn't take me long, as I don't think it would take you very long, to understand that there was a story. And you especially, as someone who's written on the United Electrical Workers, would understand that when I opened a box and the contents kind of disintegrated on touch, when I opened a box of the UE News from the late 40s and early 50s, I'll repeat that. When I opened the box of the UE News, the official newspaper of the UE, and saw article after article signed by Betty Goldstein, mm-hmm. which was her maiden name, I said to myself, there's documentation, which is crucial to a historian, and there's a story here. At that point, I still had no idea that the story involved Ferdinand's engagement with women's issues at an earlier point. I was knowing the UE, which I didn't know enough then about. I knew this was about labor unions and Ferdinand's career as a labor union journalist. I did not know what I would find eventually, which was her passionate engagement with women's issues.
Mm-hmm. So did you, when you went and discovered these papers, did you have enough information from her to know that you would find that she had been a writer in the labor press?
Yeah, when I interviewed her in 1987, and you'll appreciate this, she mentioned that she had worked for the UE, the United Electrical Workers. I had no idea at that point, the UE, a labor union, 1940s. I'm not a labor historian.
Uh-huh. So you didn't realize that this was the single largest target of McCarthyism in the labor.
I did not realize this was the union that when Ferdinand started working for it had 600,000 members, and when she finished 6 years later it had 200,000 members, not because of anything she did, but because the UE was the target of concerted attacks by a whole host of national institutions, public and private, to limit its influence. I had no idea, and this is certainly something you taught me about, that the UE was, of all American unions, one of those most concerned about issues concerning race and gender in the 40s and 50s. So she said, I worked for the UE, and it's on the tape, didn't register. Mm-hmm. Only when I came back to that issue and then started reading your work and Ron Schatz's book on the UE did I begin to realize how important a piece of evidence that was, that the UE wasn't just any union, but a union where anyone involved in it at the level she was in the late 40s and 50s would have known about the debates over women's issues. When I say women's issues, I mean sex discrimination mm-hmm. in the workplace, mm-hmm. primarily.
Specifically issues of equality.
Absolutely. Yes. Equal pay for equal work.
So doesn't take you long to figure out that there's more to Betty Friedan than is discovered in her kitchen in 1963.
Right.
Where do you go from there?
Well, this happens to historians all the time. What I thought would be a chapter became a book, and you know, almost any historian starts a project thinking it's going to be one thing, finds some interesting documents, and the book becomes something else. And that's what happened to me. I hope I'll finish the sequel someday. It's been mm-hmm. two books have come out of it, and the book on Vance Packard and now the book on Betty Friedan. And I hope I'll go back to it. But I just put it aside at that point. Mm-hmm. And initially, I thought I was still writing the chapter. And computers make it easy to just put in another three pages. What I was faced with, which was the puzzle, is if you look in Who's Who in America at Betty Friedan's entry, you'll see that there's no mention of anything she did between 1943 and 57. 55 or 6. Mm-hmm. And as I started to write the story of her life for this chapter, I came up again and again against this kind of absence, this silence. She had written an article in 1974 talking about those years. But if you looked, if I looked, which I did, at the history books, at the biographies, except for some children's biographies, there was really nothing very much written about her labor union activity in these years. So I was fortunate enough to win a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities and later to have a sabbatical from Smith, which gave me the time to write this book. So eventually what I thought was a chapter became longer and longer, and I decided to make it into a book. Not a biography. As you said, it's an intellectual biography. I'm interested in her life up to the late 60s. I think that the story I have to tell, I think, is a dramatic and interesting story. Someone else, as Judith Hennessy has done, someone else will do it more on a more full scale, tell the whole life. But I focused on the years from the early 40s to the late 60s.
So when you made these discoveries and realized that her years as a labor journalist were significant, did you go back to her and ask her about them?
Eventually, while I was working on it, I was about to go to on a trip to Washington, D.C. for a professional conference, and I wrote her. This is just when I'm beginning to work my way through the archives. And I wrote her and asked her whether when I was in Washington I could interview her. And so we had dinner together, Betty, myself, my wife, Helen Horowitz, and a very dear friend who knows all of us, who's alas now died just couple months ago, Charles Blitzer, and we had a dinner on that trip, and I asked her whether I could interview her. And she said that she believed that her agreement with her authorized biographer, Ellen Chesler, the author of a very important book on Margaret Sanger, that her agreement with her authorized biographer precluded her from giving interviews to any other historian. And I took that as I accepted that. I am a historian, or I should say that written documents are very important. They are the lifeblood of a historian. They are what we look for, what we relish finding, what we try to interpret. Oral history becomes something, especially when there aren't documents, becomes something that can supplement and amplify, but they are no substitute for an examination of the document, the documents. And her collection, the collection of her papers, are for much of her life wonderful. I'm grateful to her for having deposited them at the Schlesinger Library. For her Smith College years, 1938 to 42, she kept every lecture note she took, every, that is, notes in lecture courses she was in, kept every paper, even kept the research notes for the paper she was writing. And for some of the later years, not really until you get to 1957, not really until she starts freelancing are there unpublished documents, but for her freelance articles in the middle of the 50s, there are multiple drafts, and for the Feminine Mystique, there are multiple drafts. So it's hard for me as a historian to turn away from that. Those seemed to me rich, rich documents that needed examination.
So when did it dawn on you that you were onto something that might be somewhat problematical or that was significant in terms of the history of feminism?
Problematic I knew fairly early. About a year after I started this, so we're talking about the spring of 96, I wrote her a letter, Betty Friedan, a letter asking for permission to quote from unpublished papers. And she wrote back a letter, which made it clear to me how sensitive were some of the documents I had found, and how opposed she was to the project and how much she saw her life differently from how I saw it. Significant is a different answer. Only slowly did I begin to understand that this was part not just of labor history, but women's history. Mm-hmm. And it came in pieces. That pamphlet, 1952 pamphlet, UE Fights for Women Workers, which you had written about already, although you did not yet know it was by Friedan, and which you saw as such a significant document. I think fairly early on I found that. I wasn't initially sure it was hers. I determined that through a number of means. The other pieces of evidence came, as you know, as a historian. It looks like luck. It looks like accident. But it's a lot of dogged persistence, boring work, going through piles of paper. For example, what for me is probably the most important document, a 1943, 20 years before the Feminine Mystique, a 1943 article she writes that begins with the sentence something like, "Men, there's a revolution brewing in the American kitchen." That's a sentence that could have said, and she probably did say it in 1963.
Simmered
as well.
For 20 years.
That's right. But the fact that she understood that revolution was brewing in the kitchen and was simmering in her mind for those intervening years, finding a document like that was a very important part of the process. And often what would happen, you know this as a historian, I would see a document, I would not understand its significance, I would take notes on it.
Float
out there. It was in my computer, in a file document, the computer, and would not understand why it was important. Gradually, you find three, four, five other documents. I found at Smith when she was an undergraduate, an article that appeared, written by another woman, a Smith student. That has the title Shades of Susan B. Anthony, published in 1941. That is and at this point, young Betty Goldstein is editor of the literary journal in which this appears, so I'm sure she knew about it. And in fact, Shades of Susan B. Anthony is the answer to what we would say is a sexist piece written by an old boyfriend of hers in the same publication, a guy who was a high school classmate of hers in Peoria. So slowly, really over a period, I would say, of 8 months, you find a piece of the puzzle and another piece, and you don't immediately, there's no one moment at which you say, aha, this is about the history of feminism. And for a long period, I thought, oh, this is the history of labor union activity. And as you know, in the 1940s, there's not a clear separation between women's issues and workers' issues. So gradually that began to dawn on me that what I was writing was a history of women as well. And in the context that you certainly understand of how women's history is taught in the United States, that is, any standard textbook will say that feminism emerges in the 1960s with a number of phenomena, but including Friedan's writing of the Feminine Mystique, and that feminists in the 60s were cut off from their past, that they had no understanding that there was a past, the past they understood by reading Eleanor Flexner's Century of Struggle. But still, that feminism emerges in the 60s, I don't want to say out of nowhere, but out of a lack of a sense of historical connectedness. So the importance then of the book is a rereading of Friedan's life that tries to connect what she has disconnected, which is this earlier labor union journalism as a radical and in the 40s and early 50s, and then the later involvement in women's issues, to try to see continuity where she has seen a sharp disjuncture.
I want to pick up on what you said about puzzle pieces, because while you were describing your research process, I was thinking that it's a lot like that. You have a piece of this, a piece of that.
Absolutely.
And ultimately it comes together into a narrative.
Exactly.
What you've done is constructed a counter-narrative of Betty Friedan's upbringing and her creation as a feminist. Tell us what you came up with.
Right.
What's that narrative?
Well, the narrative begins in Peoria. In some ways, and she's talked this about herself, it begins in reaction to her own mother, Miriam Goldstein, her mother's frustration about a career as a writer that Betty Goldstein Friedan's father prevented her from having. So it begins in some ways in a mother-daughter relationship, and that we had known. But it also begins as a high school journalist. Friedan, from a very early point, knew she wanted to be a writer. And when she's 15 or 16 even, she writes a kind of fable for the high school newspaper called The Ant and the Bee, or An Ant and a Bee, which is a fable about two girls, high school girls, one of them not physically very attractive, but very brainy, and the other very attractive, very sexy, very flirtatious. And The Ant and the Bee tells the parable of the story of these lives of these two young women. One, the brainy one, becomes, I think, a stenographer to a doctor or a lawyer. That is, that's as high as she can mm-hmm. rise, not a doctor or a lawyer herself, but also only a stenographer or a stenographer. The other woman, the flirtatious, attractive, sexy one, uses her wiles to attract the attention of her teacher and marries him. And he becomes, not she, but he becomes very successful, a member in this story of Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet or brain trust. So you've got to hear a story. This is Betty Friedan, Betty Goldstein. She's only 15, mm-hmm. who understands that there are two possibilities. Doesn't exhaust the possibilities, but there are two possibilities for ambitious young women. One, use their brains but face a very low glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. The other, use their beauty, get married, and achieve success only through their husband. That, I would say, is a woman-centered or feminist consciousness. That is, already young Betty Goldstein, age 16, aware of the constricted choices that women faced. What else she learns at high school has to do with anti-fascism labor union activity. On labor union activity, Peoria is the world headquarters of Caterpillar Factory, mm-hmm. and there's a sit-down strike or some organizing activities and strikes that she's very sympathetic to. But I think more important to her as a young woman and as a Jew, the specter of the spread of Nazism and anti-Semitism mm-hmm. yes. Through Europe. Remember, 1933, Hitler comes to power. Mm-hmm. She's 22, she's 12 years old at that point, so that Hitler's march into Central Europe is occurring right when she's achieving political consciousness, 16 mm-hmm. and 17. And although I don't know for sure, I have to assume that in Peoria, Illinois, she was quite aware of what happened. We know in similar cities, which is attacks on Jewish merchants mm-hmm. By organized groups of anti-Semites. She knew about Father Coughlin, Father Charles Coughlin, the radio priest. She knew about him when she was 16, an anti-Semitic and immensely popular and powerful man of whom Franklin Roosevelt himself was scared. Father Coughlin, who was a vile anti-Semite, she knew about that. We know from the written record. So she goes off to college already sensitized on